Good evening.
Good evening, Hanok. Hello?
Jasmine, you have background noise? Jasmine, you're the only one who's on and question for tonight.
Yeah, it's me.
Do you have any questions?
Well, I have a question relating of the study that we were doing about the Sefer Yetzirah today.
Hannah.
Good evening, Hannah. Do you have any questions?
No question, but yesterday for our mini Zohar, we talked about the code that Jacob gave Rachel, and I said I would check what Midrash says, had to say about it, and there was no, they did not tell what the code was. The only thing that they said was that Rachel was in the room answering Jacob's questions because he would have recognized Leah's voice.
Right. That's all from the Midrash.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the actual codes, I have read them, I just don't remember them, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Jasmine, you want to go ahead and ask your question then?
Well, yeah, I have a question, because it says here that there are different techniques that we can use to prophesy or nibuah. But also says prophecy or making a creation. What is the difference, or what would be prophecy and making a creation?
Have you ever heard of a golem?
Yes.
Brandela.
Good evening, Brandy. Do you have any questions?
No, sir.
Okay. Jasmine has asked a question from a session that we had on the Sefer Yetzirah class. I believe it's class 8. And the question she's asking, in that handout, there is a statement relating to something called nevuah, which is the Hebrew word for prophecy, and making a creation. And I had just finished asking Jasmine if she had heard of it, of a golem. So, making a creation is utilizing the tools of the Kabbalah, the tools of the Sefer Yetzirah, the relationships of many different aspects that you then utilize and transform physicality into what you want. Whether it be a golem, or whether it would be the cow that people would slaughter on Friday night because they couldn't afford to have a cow. So on Friday night for Shabbat to have meat, they would utilize these tools to create a cow, which was then slaughtered and prepared for Shabbat. That's what making a creation refers to. Literally manipulating the physicality, the physical world, to create something. You're really not creating, but you are forming. you're using energy and physical mass, and you're changing the form of that mass, and you're injecting that mass with a consciousness of light, a consciousness of energy. And the study of the way I teach it and the way I was taught is all about being able to do that, as well as when prophecy returns, it's how to utilize and make connection to the Creator so that if He chooses to provide you with prophecy, you would be able to become a prophet. But what is prophecy? What is Nevuah? It's being shown images of the future process. What are the future potentials? When someone makes a decision, they have created a new potential that may shift the direction of the world path, or may continue that world path, or may shift it in another direction. And being able to see those potential alternatives was the images that were shown to the prophet when he went into his state of connection to the Creator. And the tools that we were teaching, that Jasmine and I were studying today, was how to achieve either one of those. The Sefer Yetzirah in Chapter 1, the tools that are being taught in Chapter 1 are similar to, they're necessary to do either path, and the paths are different. But in the first chapter of the Sefer Yetzirah, they are the same, because the practice that takes place from that chapter can be branched into either direction of creating material forms, physical forms, or being prepared to receive prophecy. So, Jasmine, I hope that's clear to you.
Well, I just want to ask you something. Why do we have a lack? Okay, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. If we are able to make a creation, we shouldn't have a lack of, you know, like money or something that we need, and if we can make it real, make a creation. Isn't it?
What you're really asking is if you have the tools to make a creation, then you should have no lack. But Jasmine, you're forgetting one thing. You're forgetting that things that are in the physical world are not a fulfillment for spiritual lacks. So if you need more money and you utilize those tools to create more money for yourself, you don't know how the world would change based on you doing that creation. That's why the people who were able to make creations, who were given this knowledge, part of that knowledge is to see the effect of your actions. So if you're going to create money, what you're doing is disturbing the economic flow of money throughout the world. Now, what would that mean? just as a hurricane grows from a mild wind. What changes it from a mild wind to a over 100 mile an hour wind that becomes a hurricane? How does that develop? Where is that energy coming from? All of those things, the person who builds a creation is given access to understanding what effects of that creation would be. If you lack that understanding, then what you are creating is going to be generally for yourself alone, and it won't be effective. As in the stories of the Golem, as in the stories in the Talmud of Rabbi Acha, the compiler of the Gemara, who after he died would come back to his family on Friday nights, appear in the physical form, create the same cows that he was creating when he was alive, and proceed. He wasn't doing it for himself. He was dead. He didn't need to eat the animal, but he was providing the meat so that his family could enjoy the Shabbat at the highest level. So if you were thinking in terms of, if I have a physical lack and I have this knowledge, I just go ahead and do it. And that's true. But if you don't understand the consequences of disturbing the physical laws in the neighborhood that you're living in, there are consequences. And you have to have the ability to see those consequences, so that you don't destroy the universe. Because ultimately, Everything is united and everything has a connection to everything else. So if you're changing an atom, because again, we're not really creating, we're transforming. It's the book of formation. We're forming, reforming physicality into something that wasn't there before. So we're taking atoms that have a purpose, or they wouldn't have been created. We don't see those atoms. We don't know where they're coming from. Are they coming from my body or your body? Are they coming from the air? Are they coming from the ground? Where are they coming from? We're taking those atoms who at one moment have one form, and we're reforming them, the book of formation, into another form. That has a consequence. Energy is added, energy is detracted. You have to understand the energy. You have to understand what the impact will be. And those are part of the tools that people who do this learn. And then politely said, it only works for people who are truly cleansed. But part of the training is to learn how to cleanse at the deepest, deep level where you can be able to perceive what the consequences of forming what you are going to form in the physical world, what's the effect of that on the physical world, so you don't destroy the physical world. And this is one of the reasons why the tools of Kabbalah were kept concealed for so many generations, and why today our desire to receive has fallen to such a low level that we can't destroy. There's a protection shield in that understanding that our desire to receive is on such a low level. So I hope I've been clear, Jasmine.
So it means that Kabbalah was more spread back in the times than it is now because of the cleansing.
Restate the word you used. You said something about Kabbalah was more what?
Kabbalah back in the times was more spread around, or people was more available than it is now?
There's a disagreement by the historians, but there is statements in many different locations that the number of people who were training to be a prophet at the feet of the Sanhedrin, all of the 70 members of the Sanhedrin, they all had students. And there's in one place it says 3 million students of the Sanhedrin studying to be prophets. In another, it's 1 million. There's a disagreement whether it's over the 400 years that the temple existed or whether it was at any given time. But it was a significant amount of people studying to be a prophet. I doubt very seriously that there's 1 million people studying Kabbalah today. I know that there are large organizations in the Kabbalah who indicate that there's a large number of people, and they speak in terms of thousands and hundreds of thousands. But when you look at their YouTube videos, you know, the highest I've seen is like 15,000 views of a YouTube video from a Kabbalah organization. So my sense is there's not 1 million people studying Kabbalah today. And what they're learning is not on the level that I'm teaching, based on what my teachers taught me, because not everybody wants all of that information. Not everybody wants to understand it. Not everybody has that desire the way I had and still have. That's not to imply that I'm such a great person, because I know better. I'm right down there with the mud, let me tell you. But I have a great desire to understand, and I have a great desire to connect to Hashem. And what I learn, I know the only way that I can be a funnel is if what I learn, what I receive, I share. But of course, there have to be students who are willing to share it, willing to receive it. It's a great responsibility to study Kabbalah. It's a great responsibility to study the deeper levels, because literally we can destroy the world, God forbid, because we are playing components of creation. What's an atom? I'm referring to ATOM. What is an atom? It's a physical essence. But I can't see it. I can't touch it. Well, you can touch it, but you can't feel it when you touch it. Just run your hand in front of your face. You're moving atoms out of the way. Those atoms are touching your hand. You don't feel them. But that's what happens. And there's a great responsibility when you take those atoms and put them into a form, into a shape. Are you creating a dead body? Or are you creating something living? When I say a dead body, maybe you're just creating a cube. A cube of wood or a cube of ice. Where does a cube of ice come from? It comes from water that you've slowed down the movement within the atom that moves it from a liquid to a solid. How does someone create a cube of ice? Take the atoms and slow down their internal energy. But what are you going to do with that energy when you do that? And it's not that complicated because the tools... One of my teachers gave me an excellent explanation. The discussion was the word Sitrei Torah or Ta'amei Torah. Ta'amei Torah means the taste of Torah. Sitrei Torah means the secrets of Torah. What we study normally, you read the Torah every day, you read the Zohar every day. The level that we study it at, we're talking about deeper levels of Ta'amei Torah than of most other people. But it's still just the taste of Torah. What is Sitrei Torah? And what is the difference? My teacher said the difference between the two is the difference between a television set and a remote control. Actually, the way it was phrased was, do you understand what a television set does? It's an antenna to bring radio waves or electromagnetic waves into this box and then display them on the screen. How do you change the screen? Well, you take a remote control and you push a button. And it goes from channel 2 to channel 200. But is there somebody who knows how to build that remote control? Yes. Is the person pushing the button one of those people who knows how to build the remote control? Probably not. What's the difference between Ta'amei Torah and Sitrei Torah? Sitrei Torah, the practitioner, the Kabbalah student, or the Kabbalist, knows how to build the remote control. Ta'amei Torah, he knows how to push the buttons on the remote control.
Wow.
Are there any other questions? Have I upset everybody?
I have a question.
Go ahead, Brandy.
Okay. What you're discussing now was similar to something I was reading today about the Sephiroth. And I was reading about the Keter. And it says that what I understood it to say was that there are 9 levels above the Keter. Is that correct?
I don't know.
There's 9 levels above the Keter. You're using the word Keter.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't sure what.
Yes, Keter. Yes.
No, there's 120. There's 124 levels. Well, maybe 114 levels above the Keter.
Okay.
How many Sephirot?
Seven.
Brandy, how many Sephirot? How many Sephirot, Brandy?
10.
Correct. And within those 10, how many Sephirot?
10 times 10 within each one.
Is 100. But what if we're talking not about the 10 Sephirot, but we combine them and we talk about Keter, Chachma, Bina, Zeranpin, and Malchut? How many Partsufim are there? There are 5. And within each of those 5, how many are there? There's 5 within each of those 5. And the Kabbalists tell us we can only go out 3 levels. So how much is 5 times 5?
25.
And 5 more, multiplied by 5 more? It's 125. And if you asked me about Keter, well, that's the 10th level from the lowest one, being Malchut of Malchut of Malchut. So how many levels are there above Keter? What you really have to learn is, what Keter are you talking about?
Okay.
If you're talking about Keter of Adam Kadmon, there's 3 worlds above that one. But how many dimensions? Infinite number of dimensions. So I'm not sure what you were reading and what its purpose was. But the answer to your question was, yes, there's more than 9 levels above Keter, depending on which Keter you're talking about and where is it located in the series of the trees of life, which is really only one tree of life because everything is unified. But we see things in separation. So when I said there's 125 levels, there's only one level. And the name of that level is Hashem. And if I've confused you, I'm glad. And if you think you understand what I said, you don't.
Well, I'm not confused, and I don't quite understand what you said, but it makes sense. I don't know. You understand what I'm saying? It makes sense.
I understand what you're saying. I'm just not sure that I ever make sense.
Well, we're in trouble.
I understand what you're saying. Well, what's built into the word making sense, or the phrase making sense, is logic. A is to B, as C is to D. But it's logic. A plus B is equal to C. All of the syllogisms, you've had it in math back when you were in school. You may have read it in the Kabbalah. That's all what the Gematria is dealing with. All of the number theories, they're all logical. But when was the last time your intuition was logical? Logic is a tool to justify your actions when you don't want to dig into what was the true motivation. And now I'm sure everybody's in shock after that statement.
No shock.
Okay.
No shock. No shock at all. I knew you would come up with something. That would have to make us grasp. Gotta keep up.
Well, that's the purpose of these questions and answers. That's the purpose of the questions and answers, is to help you grow.
As long as
help
I'm growing
expand your
up
conscience.
As long as I'm growing up and not out, I'm okay.
They're both larger vessels, aren't they?
Well, I guess.
Go ahead, honey.
No, I didn't say anything.
Somebody said something.
You just laughed.
I was just laughing at, because I believe confusion is the beginning of the real understanding, as we have said it before many times.
Confusion is the beginning of clarity. That's correct. I've said it a million times. I'll say it another million times. When you're confused, that's the beginning of understanding, the beginning of clarity. If you think you understand, all you're doing is fooling yourself. Why? Because there's another level that you haven't even touched. And when you say, I understand, you're saying, I'm going to stop looking. I'm going to stop trying to understand, because you put it in a box that says, in your mind, I understand that.
Yeah.
As long as you keep saying, I may understand this, but there's more to understand, then you're continuing to grow.
Well, that's why we're studying Kabbalah, because there's a never-ending learning.
Brandy, I just want to say one other thing that is to keep you on the straight and narrow and keep you growing up and not out.
Okay.
In Rabbi Ashlag's essays that we have studied, and I can't tell you which of the 31 of them that we've studied, it's there. Oh, it's the introduction to the 10 luminous emanations. In that, he starts out by saying, I'm paraphrasing, but he starts out by saying that since the invention of the printing press, all of these people have put out books on Kabbalah, but the majority of those books are not done by Kabbalists. The majority of those books are confusing and incorrect. So rather than read something on Kabbalah, and I am not telling you don't read what you want to read. If you're not sure, check with me whether that author is kosher. whether you're able to deal with that author. Because sometimes those things that you read are very intensely powerful, but they're not meant for you. And that's not to say you should ever stop studying Kabbalah. And it's not to say you should limit yourself to a series of books, because you don't know when you're ready to go, or you will know when you're ready to go into these other areas. But always know there's a lot of material that was prepared for, motivated by, and influenced by the Satan. And why does he do that? Because if you take a very religious man, a man very connected, he is praying three times a day. He's laying tefillin all three kinds. He's doing all kinds of tzedakah and all kinds of mitzvot, all kinds of good deeds. His whole life is about connecting to God. Satan says, oh, this is a guy I got to work with. This is a guy I want to influence, because he's going to influence other people. So how do I bring him down? I have two ways of bringing him down. One is creating blockages so he can't do the mitzvah, the mitzvot. He's so busy with his goodness, he doesn't get time to go pray. A blockage. But there's another way. Satan will come at him and say, oh, you prayed three times today. That's great. Why don't you do tikkun chatzot tonight? Do a little more. Burn yourself out a little more. Satan works both ends against the middle. These are his tools. And he's had 5,000 years of practice. And you've had 33? Now you can say thank you, Hano.
Thank you, Hano. 33.
33.
Thank you, Hano.
What was that, Malka? Or was that Brandy, was that you? And I thought it was Malka.
Yes, that was me. I said thank you.
Well, I heard the thank you from you, and then I heard something else. So I thought it was Malka, but it, you know, because both of you have the same East Texas accent, so.
Well, I do confuse your
voices sometimes, but I apologize.
You know, birds of a feather.
That's true. And that's Satan. It's influencing me to make a mistake like that.
Well, Mark and I, we see each other. So, I guess if you hang around
with somebody long enough,
you begin to sound like them.
That's what they say about old married couples.
Well, that I've seen that. That's true. That really is true.
So does anybody have any other questions or comments?
I don't know if I'm asking too many questions, but I have one.
Good. There is no such thing as too many questions.
Yes. Okay. So I don't know if somebody else has a question before me asking again.
No, you're up, Jasmine. Go ahead.
Okay. My question is based on the proof of ancestry, of Jewish ancestry in your genes, in your DNA. What difference does it make if you take a DNA test and you find out that you have a Jewish ancestry and not knowing that?
It depends on what you do with the information. Just because your DNA says that you have Jewish ancestry doesn't mean that you are going to be attracted to learning about Judaism in this lifetime. If you know anything about genes and DNA, you have certain genes that mean you can have, God forbid, diabetes. But not everybody with that gene gets diabetes. What's the difference? Every gene has a switch that turns it on or turns it off. And those switches may even be, we're not sure. I'm not sure yet. I don't know where science is. And I don't know where the Kabbalists are, but nobody has told me. But my intuition says that switch is like a rheostat on the wall. You can turn the light up stronger and stronger and stronger, or down weaker and weaker and weaker. But that switch turns on the gene. So those people who merit, God forbid, diabetes, that their switch on that gene gets turned on. And for those people who don't have that merit, thank God, that switch never turns on the diabetes combination of genes, because it's never just one gene, it's a whole, you know, combination of them. But that's the way DNA works. So if somebody says, I have the Cohen-Im gene, which is something that people were interested in, meaning that the all the way back in the time of Moses, their progenitor, their forefather was Aaron HaCohen. And they're carrying the gene. And they get the DNA test and they say, oh, wow, I'm a Cohen. Well, no, you're not. Because it's very possible that through that line, well, it wouldn't be that way, but it's very possible that through that line there was a mixture, because the Cohen gene is only on the men. And if somewhere in that line there was a woman who was not a Jewish person, that gene can exist on somebody. He thinks he's Jewish, but there was a break in the line. Now, that's assuming that you follow the laws of the Orthodox. To the person who's being raised in the Reform movement, it wouldn't make any difference, because they evaluate who is a Jewish person based on both the patrilineal and the matrilineal. But it really boils down to, oh, I got this information on a Cohen. What am I going to do with that? How does it change my life? I found out that I have a Jewish gene. I have a Cohen gene, but my parents have been Catholics for 10 generations. what am I going to do with that? Am I going to study Judaism? Am I going to convert to Judaism? Or it's just part of my DNA makeup, and the purpose of DNA is to pass it on to the next generation. And in that generation, they'll do another DNA test. They'll find out, wow, I have a Cohen gene. And in that generation, that soul will go searching and find their way back to being Jewish through the conversion process. It's not as demonstrative. It's not as common today. But when I started to study Kabbalah, one of the things I started to study was the Brit Milah, the circumcision. And I learned a lot of things about the Brit Milah that when I would go to both my parents had passed away by that time. So I went to my aunts. Do you remember my Brits? Oh, yeah, sure. Who was the moil? Who was the person doing it? It was done in the hospital by the doctor. Do you know if he did all three levels? I don't know what you're talking about, was her answer. So here was everybody knows I was born Jewish. I was circumcised. But was I circumcised? Who knows for sure? I wasn't conscious of it at the moment, and there was nobody who really was there, because who knows, even knows what the doctor's name was. So to make sure, I had a second Brit Milah. And it's not uncommon in today's generation that it's necessary. And it's not uncommon that it happens. It's the same idea. You get information, what will you do with the information? I hope my metaphor was clear, my example was clear.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's always about what you do with the information. What will motivate you to change yourself? And another caution, just because the doctors and the scientists today say there's no mistakes in DNA, wait 20 years and see if that's still true.
Hello, this is Malka.
Welcome.
Hello?
How are you?
Good. I heard today, this is just a statement, just kind of want some commentary on it, I guess. I heard today that did surveys in the colleges, and 77% of the college students stated that the sex of a child is not determined in the womb, that it is determined when they decide what their sex is as they grow into the world. So what's your comment about that survey?
Science is catching up to Kabbalah again still. The Talmud, you list seven different Hebrew words for the sex of a child. So until they have seven categories, they're not right. They're not complete. Well, everybody knows there's only two sexes, right?
Right.
Well, not really. And in the study of reincarnation, we will discuss how the soul settles into the body in the womb on the 40th day. And it's at that point that the sex is determined by the soul, but it can be changed up until the birth.
Well, I think that the survey was about they make that choice as to what sex they want to be. They're saying outside the womb, not it's.
When you say outside the womb, you're talking about the soul of the child. That's correct. The soul of the child determines the sex of the child. But there are times when the male soul, the male half of the soul, needs to experience what it feels like to be a woman or vice versa. And so they will change. And it can be changed in the womb, as I said, up until the moment of birth is what we study in Kabbalah.
Which is what happened with Dina.
You're beginning to hear something.
When Leah had Dina.
I didn't hear what she said.
I said, isn't that what happened with Leah when she had Dina?
Right. That was one of the midrashim about Dina was that she was to be the seventh boy, but she had pity on her sister. And so she changed the sex to female.
Who had pity on her sister? You mean Leah had pity on Rachel?
Yes. Because she already had six boys when she had Dina.
Okay.
So the seventh child. And the two handmaids had two children each, so they were already at 10. And if she had a seventh boy, then Rachel would at most have one son. And so she took, she didn't want her sister to study, and the Midrash said that she changed the male fetus into a female. So this is nothing new in Kabbalah. We've known this. Science is just catching up.
So with Dina's soulmate was born into a different family because she was a single birth.
That's correct. Her soulmate was Shem, the son of the king of where Jacob settled, the city of Shem.
Okay.
And that's why part of the reason that they settled there is so that would take place.
But he was killed by Levi and
Shimon. But he killed as a consequence of his lack of control when he was with his soulmate. He raped her.
Right. Is that why Shimon
He didn't control
took,
his life.
Is that why Shimon took her, Dina, under his wing or into his family?
very possibly. Again, this is a midrash, so we don't know if it's completely true or partially true, and it could be a different dimension that that took place in. So we're not sure, but that is very possible, is that would be the reason why that would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because since he killed her soulmate, by marrying her, he completed what would happen with her. And she did have a child by that soulmate. And that was the adopted daughter of Potiphar's wife.
Right.
Who ended up marrying Joseph.
Right. So that was basically Joseph's soulmate at that point.
Correct.
And they were, Joseph and Dina were really close, as in...
they were brother and sister.
Yeah, they were really close. They were had close ties to one another.
Well, as is natural in a big family, you have mm-hmm. you have children who are close together in age who grow closer together.
And she, Dina ended up in Egypt, didn't she?
That's what one of the midrash said. One of the midrash says that when Shimon married her, and when she was when the pregnancy she became close to being due, she was sent into Egypt, and that's where Potiphar's wife saw her. And in Egypt at those times, there were two castes of women, two levels of women. One group of women were for bearing children, and one for not bearing children. And Potiphar's wife was for not bearing children, but she wanted a child, and so she adopted this child that came from Dina. That's according to the Midrash. But we don't know the exact truth and won't until the resurrection, when we can go up and ask them.
And since you brought that up, resurrection, is the righteous, will resurrect, people from their resting places? Or would it be just the Mashiach?
The answer is yes.
To both questions.
You want me to explain that?
Yeah, please.
Which dimension? Which potential dimension are you referring to? Every time there's a decision point in anybody's life, there's a new potential.
Correct.
And there's a continuation of the old potential. It doesn't just stop, it continues. So we have all of these different potential worlds called Earth in all these different dimensions. So which one are you talking about?
I think you pretty much answered my question.
Okay.
I think that each generation, the way I see it, each generation will have their righteous ones that would resurrect their people in that generation. So, like you said, we have a Mashiach that is potential in every generation. And that Mashiach will raise the dead for that generation.
Or he will authorize some scientists to raise the dead. That's also a possibility in some of the potential of some of the potential earth. So don't limit yourself just to understand it that way. There's always different ways of understanding these things, of perceiving these. But just as a general rule, the Mashiach will be authorizing the timing of the resurrection of the dead. That's one of his jobs. And he will only do that when he is told as that it's the right time to do that.
So it can happen and it can happen in different seasons, I guess was the word I'm going to use.
Well, there's discussion that it can only happen in Scorpio, in the month of Heshvan. But there's other time. There are other people who say it will happen in different months. Scorpio doesn't have a holiday, so that's one of the reasons that they relate to.
That would be a joyful festival when that happens, since there is no holiday.
Amen. There's also no holiday in Tibet, other than the first 2 days, the last 2 days of Hanukkah. And there's no holiday in Cancer either, in the month of Tammuz. And there's no holiday in the month of Elul.
So with that said about the Mashiach, you said, well, we understand from the teachings that you so graciously give us that Mashiach is potential in every generation. But that Mashiach does not know that they are at that point. But when it comes down to the Mashiach giving authorization, they will know that they were the potential Mashiach at that time.
That's
they will
correct.
Know that.
They will no longer be potential, they will be actual.
Right. Wow, that's a great reward, don't you? I just think that's a great reward for those potential Mashiachs. How joyful will that be to those righteous individuals, whomever they are?
It will be joyful, but it will also be, it's not so much that it's a joyful event, it is a joyful event, but it's also an acceptance of his responsibility. Always remember when there's cause and effect. The revelation of the Mashiach is very joyful, but only if he accepts the responsibility, and he will have free choice.
They will have free
and
choice.
He may not be willing. Of course, everyone has free choice. If he doesn't want to, accept the responsibility, it'll go to another person.
And you're talking about at the time of resurrection. Is that the time that we're speaking of?
Well, that's what we refer to it as the end times.
Okay.
Because there's a three-step process of rebuilding Jerusalem, building Jerusalem, the gathering of the exiles, and the resurrection. That's the three-step process. And there's a lot of steps in the middle of those three. But unless you have something important, I don't mean to imply that this wasn't important. We're out of time. But I'll continue to answer questions if you still want to talk.
No, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome. I bid you all a beautiful evening. Tomorrow at 4:30 will be a mini Zohar class. At 7 o'clock will be a regular Zohar class. And I remind you that Rosh Chodesh Kislev connection will be Motzi Shabbat at our 7 p.m. class. Shalom to all.
Shalom.
Shalom.
Thank you.